Chapter 4. The Knowledge of God. Having considered the arguments in favor of the doctrine that God is, and also the various systems opposed to theism, we come now to consider the question, can God be known? And if so, how? That is, how does the mind proceed in forming its idea of God, and how do we know that God really is what we believe Him to be? Section 1. God can be known. It is the clear doctrine of the Scriptures that God can be known. Our Lord teaches that eternal life consists in the knowledge of God and of Jesus Christ, whom He hath sent. The psalmist says, in Judah is God known, Psalm 76:1. Isaiah predicts that the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, Isaiah 11:9. Paul says even of the heathen that they knew God, but did not like to retain that knowledge, Romans 1:19, 20, 21. 28. A state of the question. It is, however, important distinctly to understand what is meant when it is said, God can be known. 1. This does not mean that we can know all that is true concerning God. There were some among the ancient philosophers who taught that the nature of God can be as fully understood and determined as any other object of knowledge. The modern speculative school teaches the same doctrine. Among the propositions laid down by Spinoza, we find the following: cognitio erat ad infinit essenti Dei, quam anacui idea involvit, est ad vata et perfecta. 325. Hegel says that God is only so far as He is known. The sin against the Holy Ghost, according to Hegel, is to deny that He can be known. 326. Cousin holds the same doctrine. God, in fact, he says, exists to us only in so far as He is known. 327. According to Schelling, God is known in His own nature by direct intuition of the higher reason. He assumes that there is in man a power which transcends the limits of the ordinary consciousness and Antrones Vermen, which takes immediate cognizance of the infinite. Hegel says that man knows God only so far as God knows Himself in man. This knowledge is God's self-consciousness, but likewise a knowledge of the same by man, and this knowledge of God by man is the knowledge of man by God. 328. Cousin finds this knowledge in the common consciousness of men. The consciousness includes the knowledge of the infinite as well as of the finite. We know the one just as we know the other, and we cannot know the one without knowing the other. These philosophers all admit that we could not thus know God unless we were ourselves God. Self-knowledge, with them, is the knowledge of God. Reason in man, according to Cousin, does not belong to his individuality. It is infinite, impersonal, and divine. Our knowledge of God, therefore, is only God knowing Himself. Of course, it is in no such sense as this that the Scriptures and the Church teach that God can be known. God inconceivable. 2. It is not held that God, properly speaking, can be conceived of. That is, we cannot form a mental image of God. All conception, says Mr. Mansell, 329, implies imagination. To have a valid conception of a horse, he adds, we must be able to combine the attributes which form the definition of the animal into a representative image. Conception is defined by Taylor in the same manner as the forming or bringing an image or idea into the mind by an effort of the will. In the sense of the word, it must be admitted that the infinite is not an object of knowledge. We cannot form an image of infinite space, or of infinite duration, or of an infinite whole. To form an image is to limit, to circumscribe. But the infinite is that which is incapable of limitation. It is admitted, therefore, that the infinite God is inconceivable. We can form no representative image of Him in our minds. The word, however, is often, and perhaps commonly, used in a less restricted sense. To conceive is to think. A conception is therefore a thought and not necessarily an image. To say, therefore, that God is conceivable, in common language, is merely to say that He is thinkable. That is, that the thought or idea of God involves no contradiction or impossibility. We cannot think of a round square, or that a part is equal to the whole. But we can think that God is infinite and eternal. God incomprehensible. 3. When it is said that God can be known, it is not meant that He can be comprehended. To comprehend is to have a complete and exhaustive knowledge of an object. It is to understand its nature and its relations. We cannot comprehend force, and especially vital force. We see its effect, but we cannot understand its nature or the mode in which it acts. It would be strange that we should know more of God than of ourselves, or of the most familiar objects of sense. God is past finding out. We cannot understand the Almighty unto perfection. To comprehend is 1. To know the essence as well as the attributes of an object. 2. It is to know not some only, but all of its attributes. 3. To know the relation in which these attributes stand to each other and to the substance to which they belong. 4. To know the relation in which the object known stands to all other objects. Such knowledge is clearly impossible in a creature, either of itself or of anything out of itself. It is, however, substantially thus that the transcendentalists claim to know God. Our knowledge of God partial. 4. It is included in what has been said, that our knowledge of God is partial and inadequate. There is infinitely more in God than we have any idea of. And what we do know, we know imperfectly. We know that God knows. But there is much in his mode of knowing, and in its relation to its objects, which we cannot understand. We know that he acts. But we do not know how he acts, or the relation which his activity bears to time, or things out of himself. We know that he feels. That he loves, pities, is merciful, is gracious. That he hates sin. But this emotional element of the divine nature is covered with an obscurity as great, but no greater, than that which rests over his thoughts or purposes. Here again our ignorance, or rather, the limitation of our knowledge concerning God, finds a parallel in our ignorance of ourself. There are potentialities in our nature of which, in our present state of existence, we have no idea. And even as to what we are now, we know but little. We know that we perceive, think, and act. We do not know how. It is perfectly inscrutable to us how the mind takes cognizance of matter. How the soul acts on the body, or the body on the mind. But because our knowledge of ourselves is thus partial and imperfect, no sane man would assert that we have no self-knowledge. The common doctrine on this subject is clearly expressed by Descartes' 330 Seripotist, Diem es infinitum et omnipotentum, quamquam anima nostra, ut pot finita, id nequit comprehender sub concipir. Iatam namira modo, quo montem unibus tangere possumus, sed non ad arborem, ad alium quampiam rembrachis nostris non majorem amplecti comprehender enim est cogitationi complecti. Ad hoc autem, ut siamus aliquid, sufficit, ut illud cogitationi accingimus. Even Spinoza 331 says ad cucinem tuam, and ad Deo tam clarium, quam di triangulo habim idem, respondeo affirmando. Non dico, mi diem omnino cognoscer. Sed micu amigis attributa, non autem omnia, nec maximum intelligere partem, et certum est, plurimorum ignorantiam, quondam iram haber notitiam, non impedere. Quam Euclidus elementa ad iserem, primoters triangulae angulos duabis rectus vari intelligibum. Hanc triangulae proprietatem clare percipibum, licet multarum aliarum ineris essem. While, therefore, it is admitted not only that the infinite God is incomprehensible, and that our knowledge of him is both partial and imperfect. That there is much in God which we do not know at all, and that what we know very imperfectly. Nevertheless our knowledge, as far as it goes, is true knowledge. God really is what we believe him to be, so far as our idea of him is determined by the revelation which he has made of himself in his works, in the constitution of our nature, in his word, and in the person of his Son. To know is simply to have such apprehensions of an object as conform to what that object really is. We know what the word Spirit means. We know what the words infinite, eternal, and immutable mean. And, therefore, the sublime proposition, pregnant with more truth than was ever compressed in any other sentence, God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and immutable, conveys to the mind as distinct an idea, and as true that is, trustworthy knowledge, as the proposition the human soul is a finite spirit. In this sense, God is an object of knowledge. He is not the unknown God, because He is infinite. Knowledge in Him does not cease to be knowledge because it is omniscience. Power does not cease to be power because it is omnipotence. Any more than space ceases to be space because it is infinite. B. How do we know God? How does the mind proceed in forming its idea of God? The older theologians answer this question by saying that it is by the way of negation, by the way of immanence, and by the way of causality. That is, we deny to God any limitation. We ascribe to Him every excellence in the highest degree. And we refer to Him as the great first cause, every attribute manifested in His works. We are the children of God, and, therefore, we are like Him. We are, therefore, authorized to ascribe to Him all the attributes of our own nature as rational creatures, without limitation, and to an infinite degree. If we are like God, God is like us. This is the fundamental principle of all religion. This is the principle which Paul assumed in his address to the Athenians, Acts 17:29. Forasmuch then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold, or silver, or stone, graven by art and man's device. For the same reason we ought not to think that He is simple being, or a mere abstraction, a name for the moral order of the universe, or the unknown and unknowable cause of all things, mere inscrutable force. If we are His children, He is our Father, whose image we bear, and of whose nature we partake. This, in the proper sense of the word, is anthropomorphism, a word much abused, and often used in a bad sense to express the idea that God is altogether such a one as ourselves, a being of like limitations and passions. In the sense, however, just explained, it expresses the doctrine of the Church and of the great mass of mankind. Jacobi 332 well says, we confess, therefore, to an anthropomorphism inseparable from the conviction that man bears the image of God, and maintain that besides this anthropomorphism, which has always been called theism, is nothing but atheism or fetichism. 100 proof that this method is trustworthy. That this method of forming an idea of God is trustworthy, is proved. 1. Because it is a law of nature. Even in the lowest form of fetichism, the life of the worshipper is assumed to belong to the object which he worships. The power dreaded is assumed to possess attributes like our own. In like manner, under all the forms of polytheism, the gods of the people have been intelligent personal agents. It is only in the schools of philosophy that we find a different method of forming an idea of the Godhead. They have substituted to un for ho on, to the un for ho theos, to agathon for ho agathos. It is here as with regard to the knowledge of the external world. The mass of mankind believe that things are what they perceive them to be. This philosophers deny. They affirm that we do not perceive the things themselves, but certain ideas, species, or images of the things. That we have, and can have, no knowledge of what the things themselves really are. So they say we can have no knowledge of what God is. We only know that we are led to think of Him in a certain way, but we are not only not authorized to believe that our idea corresponds to the reality, but, say they, it is certain that God is not what we take Him to be. As the people are right in the one case, so are they in the other. In other words, our conviction that God is what He has revealed Himself to be, rests on the same foundation as our conviction that the external world is what we take it to be. That foundation is the veracity of consciousness, or the trustworthiness of the laws of belief which God has impressed upon our nature. Invincibility of belief, according to Sir William Hamilton, is convertible with the truth of belief, 333, although, unhappily, on this subject, he did not adhere to his own principle, that what is by nature necessarily believed to be, truly is. 334 No man has more nobly or more earnestly vindicated this doctrine, which is the foundation of all science and of all faith. Consciousness, he says, once convicted of falsehood, and unconditioned skepticism, in regard to the character of our intellectual being, is the melancholy but only rational result. Any conclusion may now with impunity be drawn against the hopes and the dignity of human nature. Our personality, our immateriality, our moral liberty, have no longer an argument for their defense. Man is the dream of a shadow. God is the dream of that dream. 335. The only question, therefore, is, are we invincibly led to think of God as possessing the attributes of our rational nature? This cannot be denied. For universality proves invincibility of belief. And it is a historical fact that men have universally thus thought of God. Even Mr. Mansell 336 exclaims against the transcendentalists, fools, to dream that man can escape from himself, that human reason can draw aught but a human portrait of God. True, he denies the correctness of that portrait. Or, at least, he asserts that we cannot know whether it is correct or not. But this is not now the question. He admits that we are forced by the constitution of our nature thus to think of God. And by the fundamental principle of all true philosophy, what we are forced to believe must be true. It is true, therefore, that God really is what we take him to be, when we ascribe to him the perfections of our own nature, without limitation, and to an infinite degree. Our moral nature demands this idea of God. 2. It has already been shown, when speaking of the moral argument for the existence of God, that all men are conscious of their accountability to a being superior to themselves, who knows what they are and what they do, and who has the will and purpose to reward or punish men according to their works. The God, therefore, who is revealed to us in our nature, is a God who knows, and wills, and acts, who rewards and punishes. That is, he is a person, an intelligent, voluntary agent, endowed with moral attributes. This revelation of God must be true. It must make known to us what God really is, or our nature is a lie. All this Mr. Mansell, who holds that God cannot be known, admits. He admits that a sense of dependence on a superior power is a fact of the inner consciousness. That this superior power is not an inexorable fate, or immutable law, but a being having at least so far the attributes of personality, that he can show favor or severity to those dependent upon him, and can be regarded by them with the feelings of hope, and fear, and reverence, and gratitude. 337. No man, however, is, or can be grateful to the sun, or to the atmosphere, or to an intelligent force. Gratitude is a tribute of a person to a person. Again, the same author admits that the moral reason, or will, or conscience of man, call it by what name we please, can have no authority save as implanted in him by some higher spiritual being, as a law emanating from a lawgiver. 338. We are thus compelled, he says, by the consciousness of moral obligation, to assume the existence of a moral and of course of a personal deity, and to regard the absolute standard of right and wrong as constituted by the nature of that deity. 339. Our argument from these facts is, that if our moral nature compels us to believe that God is a person, he must be a person, and consequently that we arrive at a true knowledge of God by attributing to him the perfections of our own nature. Our religious nature makes the same demand. 3. The argument from our religious, as distinct from our moral nature, is essentially the same. Morality is not all of religion. The one is as much a law and necessity of our nature as the other. To worship, in the religious sense of the word, is to ascribe infinite perfection to its object. It is to express to that object out acknowledgments for the blessings we enjoy, and to seek their continuance. It is to confess, and praise, and pray, and to adore. We cannot worship the law of gravity, or unconscious force, or the mere order of the universe. Our religious nature, in demanding an object of supreme reverence, love, and confidence, demands a personal God, a God clothed with the attributes of a nature like our own. Who can hear our confessions, praises, and prayers? Who can love, and be loved? Who can supply our wants, and fill all our capacities for good? Thus again it appears that unless our whole nature is a contradiction and a falsehood, we arrive at a true knowledge of God when we ascribe to him the perfections of our own nature. Mr. Mansell admits that our nature does demand a personal and moral deity. But, he says, the very conception of our moral nature is in itself the conception of a limit, for morality is the compliance with a law. And a law, whether imposed from within or from without, can only be conceived to operate by limiting the range of possible actions. 340 inches like manner, he says, The only human conception of personality is that of limitation. Therefore, if God be infinite, he can neither be a person nor possess moral attributes. This is the argument of Strauss and of all other pantheists against the doctrine of a personal God. Mr. Mansell admits the force of the argument and says we must renounce all hope of knowing what God is and be content with regulative knowledge, which teaches not what God really is, but what he wills us to think him to be. We are thus forbidden to trust to our necessary beliefs. We must not regard as true what God by the constitution of our nature forces us to believe. This is to subvert all philosophy and all religion, and to destroy the difference between the rational and the irrational. Why is this contradiction between reason and conscience, between our rational and moral nature, assumed to exist? Simply because philosophers choose to give such a definition of morality and personality that neither can be predicated of an infinite being. It is not true that either morality or personality imply any limitation inconsistent with absolute perfection. We do not limit God when we say he cannot be irrational as well as rational, unconscious as well as conscious, finite as well as infinite, evil as well as good. The only limitation admitted is the negation of imperfection. Reason is not limited when we say it cannot be unreason. Or spirit, when we say that it is not matter. Or light, when we say it is not darkness. Or space, when we say it is not time. We do not, therefore, limit the infinite when we exalt him in our conceptions from the unconscious to the conscious, from the unintelligent to the intelligent, from an impersonal something to the absolutely perfect personal Jehovah. All these difficulties arise from confounding the ideas of infinite and all. 4. The fourth argument on this subject is that if we are not justified in referring to God the attributes of our own nature, then we have no God. The only alternative is anthropomorphism in this sense or atheism. An unknown God, a God of whose nature and of whose relation to us we know nothing, to us is nothing. It is a historical fact that those who reject this method of forming our idea of God, who deny that we are to refer to him the perfections of our own nature, have become atheists. They take the word spirit and strip from it consciousness, intelligence, will, and morality. And the residue, which is blank nothing, they call God. Hamilton and Mansell take refuge from this dreadful conclusion in faith. They say that reason forbids the ascription of these, or of any other attributes, to the infinite and absolute, but that faith protests against this conclusion of the reason. Such protest, however, is of no account, unless it be rational. One can't prove that there was no rational evidence of the existence of God, and fell back from the speculative to the practical reason that is, from reason to faith, his followers universally gave up all faith in a personal God. No man can believe in the impossible. And if reason pronounces that it is impossible that the infinite should be a person, faith in his personality is an impossibility. This M.R. Mansell does not admit. For while he says that it is a contradiction to affirm the infinite to be a person, or to possess moral attributes, he nevertheless says that anthropomorphism is the indispensable condition of all human theology. 341 And he quotes from Kit 342 this passage. We may confidently challenge all natural theology to name a single distinctive attribute of the deity, whether denoting intelligence or will, which, apart from anthropomorphism, is anything more than a mere word, to which not the slightest notion can be attached, which can serve to extend our theoretical knowledge. It is greatly to be lamented that men should teach that the only way in which it is possible for us to form an idea of God leads to no true knowledge. It does not teach us what God is, but what we are forced against reason to think he is. Argument from the revelation of God in nature. 5. A fifth argument is from the fact that the works of God manifest a nature like our own. It is a sound principle that we must refer to a cause the attributes necessary to account for its effects. If the effects manifest intelligence, will, power, and moral excellence, these attributes must belong to the cause. As, therefore, the works of God are a revelation of all these attributes on a most stupendous scale, they must belong to God in an infinite degree. This is only saying that the revelation made of God in the external world agrees with the revelation which he has made of himself in the constitution of our own nature. In other words, it proves that the image of himself which he has stamped on our nature is a true likeness. Argument from Scripture. 6. The Scriptures declare God to be just what we are led to think he is, when we ascribe to him the perfections of our own nature in an infinite degree. We are self-conscious, so is God. We are spirits, so is he. We are voluntary agents, so is God. We have a moral nature, miserably defaced indeed, God has moral excellence in infinite perfection. We are persons, so is God. All this the Scriptures declare to be true. The great primal revelation of God is as the I Am, the personal God. All the names and titles given to him, all the attributes ascribed to him, all the works attributed to him, are revelations of what he truly is. He is the Elohim, the Mighty One, the Holy One, the Omnipresent Spirit. He is the Creator, the Preserver, the Governor of all things. He is our Father. He is the Hearer of Prayer, the Giver of all good. He feeds the young ravens. He clothes the flowers of the field. He is love. He so loved the world as to give his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him might not perish but have everlasting life. He is merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth. He is a present help in every time of need, a refuge, a high tower, an exceeding great reward. The relations in which, according to the Scriptures, we stand to God, are such as we can sustain only to a being who is like ourselves. He is our ruler and Father, with whom we can commune. His favor is our life, his loving kindness better than life. This sublime revelation of God in his own nature and in his relation to us is not a delusion. It is not mere regulative truth, or it would be a deceit and mockery. It makes God known to us as he really is. We therefore know God, although no creature can understand the Almighty unto perfection. Argument from the Manifestation of God in Christ. 7. Finally, God has revealed himself in the person of his Son. No man knoweth the Father but the Son. Any to whom the Son shall reveal him. Jesus Christ is the true God. The revelation which he made of himself was the manifestation of God. He and the Father are one. The words of Christ were the words of God. The works of Christ were the works of God. The love, mercy, tenderness, the forgiving grace, as well as the holiness, the severity and power manifested by Christ, were all manifestations of what God truly is. We see, therefore, as with our own eyes, what God is. We know that although infinite and absolute, he can think, act, and will. That he can love and hate. That he can hear prayer and forgive sins, that we can have fellowship with him, as one person can commune with another. Philosophy must veil her face in the presence of Jesus Christ, as God manifest in the flesh. She may not presume in that presence to say that God is not, and is not known to be, what Christ himself most clearly was. This doctrine that God is the object of certain and true knowledge lies at the foundation of all religion, and therefore must never be given up. Section 2. God cannot be fully known. The modern German philosophers take the ground that all science, all true philosophy, must be founded on the knowledge of being, and not of phenomena. They reject the authority of the senses and of consciousness, and teach that it is only by the immediate cognition of the absolute that we arrive at any true or certain knowledge. God, or rather, the infinite, can be as thoroughly known and comprehended as the simplest object of sense or of consciousness. He is, only so far as he is known. It would seem impossible that the presumption of men should be so extreme that such a creature as man should pretend to understand the Almighty to perfection, when in fact he cannot understand himself or the simplest objects with which he is in daily contact. The assumption is that being, as such, infinite and absolute being, can be known. That is, that we can determine what it is, and the necessary laws by which it is developed into the phenomenal world. This knowledge is attained a priori, not by any induction or deduction from our own nature or the facts of experience, but by an immediate act of cognition, which transcends all consciousness. The great service rendered by Sir William Hamilton and Mr. Mansell to the cause of truth was to demonstrate the utter futility of this pretended philosophy of the infinite, on the principles of its advocates. To the common mind it needed no refutation, being intuitively seen to be impossible and absurd. Sir William Hamilton's argument. Hamilton shows, in the first place, that the immediate intuition of Schelling, which Hegel ridiculed as a mere imagination, the dialectics of Hegel, which Schelling pronounced a mere play of words, and the impersonal reason of Cousin, which enters into our consciousness but not into our personality, utterly failed to give us a knowledge of the infinite. Existence, he says, is revealed to us only under specific modifications, and these are known only under the conditions of our faculties of knowledge. Things in themselves, matter, mind, God, all in short that is not finite, relative, and phenomenal, as bearing no analogy to our faculties, is beyond the verge of our knowledge. 343 What sense Hamilton places God beyond the verge of our knowledge will be seen in the sequel. It is, however, self-evident that our knowledge must be limited by our faculties of knowing. Other animals may have senses which we do not possess. It is utterly impossible that we should have the kind of knowledge due to the exercise of those senses. It is probable that there are faculties dormant in our nature which are not called into activity in our present state of being. It is clear that we cannot now attain the knowledge which those faculties may hereafter enable us to attain. It is just as plain that we cannot cognize the infinite, in the sense of these philosophers, as that we cannot see a spirit, or guide ourselves in space, as does the carrier pigeon or the migrating salmon. Only the infinite can know the infinite. 2. In the second place, it is admitted that none but the infinite can know the infinite, and to know God in this sense, it is admitted that we must be God. Schelling claimed for the mind of man, what Kant had demonstrated to be impossible, a faculty of intellectual intuition which is apart from sense, above consciousness, and released from the laws of the understanding, and which comprehends the absolute by becoming the absolute, and thus knows God by being God. 344 This assumption that man is God shocks the reason and common sense of men as well as outrages their religious and moral convictions. 3. In the third place, Hamilton and Mansell demonstrate that, assuming the definitions of the absolute and infinite given by the transcendentalists, the most contradictory conclusions may logically be deduced from them. There are three terms familiar as household words in the vocabulary of philosophy, which must be taken into account in every system of metaphysical theology. To conceive the deity as he is, we must conceive him as first cause, as absolute, and as infinite. By first cause, is meant that which produces all things, and is itself produced of none. By the absolute, is meant that which exists in and by itself, having no necessary relation to any other being. By the infinite, is meant that which is free from all possible limitation. That than which a greater is inconceivable, and which, consequently, can receive no additional attribute or mode of existence which it had not from all eternity. 345. According to these definitions, in the sense in which they are intended to be taken, it follows. 1. That the infinite and absolute must include the sum of all being. For that which is conceived as absolute and infinite must be conceived as containing within itself the sum, not only of all actual, but of all possible modes of being. For if any actual mode can be denied of it, it is related to that mode and limited by it. And if any possible mode can be denied of it, it is capable of becoming more than it now is, and such a capability is a limitation. 346. 2. If the absolute and infinite be as above defined, it cannot be the object of knowledge. To know is to limit. It is to distinguish the object of knowledge from other objects. We cannot conceive, says Hamilton, of an absolute whole. That is, of a whole so great that we cannot conceive of it as a part of a greater whole. We cannot conceive of an infinite line, or of infinite space, or of infinite duration. We may as well think without thought, as to assign any limit beyond which there can be no extension, no space, no duration. Goad imagination to the utmost, it still sinks paralyzed within the bounds of time. 347 It follows, therefore, from the very nature of knowledge, according to Hamilton, that the infinite and absolute cannot be known. The infinite cannot know. 3. It also follows from these premises, that the infinite cannot know. All knowledge is limitation and difference. It supposes a distinction between subject and object, between the knower and what is known, inconsistent with the idea of the absolute. 4. It follows also that the absolute cannot be conscious, for consciousness involves a distinction between the self and the not-self. It is knowledge of ourselves as distinct from what is not ourselves. Even if conscious only of itself, there is the same distinction between subject and object. The self as subject and a mode of the self as the object of consciousness. The almost unanimous voice of philosophy, says Mansell, in pronouncing that the absolute is both one and simple must be accepted as the voice of reason also, so far as reason has any voice in the matter. The conception of an absolute and infinite consciousness contradicts itself. 348. The absolute cannot be cause. 5. It is equally clear that the absolute and infinite cannot be cause. Causation implies relation. The relation of efficiency to the effect. It also implies change. Change from an action to activity. It moreover implies succession, and succession implies existence in time. A thing existing absolutely that is, not under relation, says Hamilton, and a thing existing absolutely as a cause, are contradictory. He quotes Schelling 349 as saying, he would deviate wide as the poles from the idea of the absolute, who would think of defining its nature by the notion of activity. But he who would define the absolute by the notion of a cause, he adds, would deviate still more widely from its nature, inasmuch as the notion of a cause involves not only the notion of a determination to activity, but of a determination to a particular, nay a dependent, kind of activity. 350. The three conceptions, the cause, the absolute, the infinite, all equally indispensable, do they not, asks Mr. Mansell, 351 imply contradiction to each other, when viewed in conjunction, as attributes of one and the same being? A cause cannot, as such, be absolute. The absolute cannot, as such, be cause. 6. According to the laws of our reason and consciousness, there can be no duration without succession, but succession as implying change cannot be predicated of the absolute and infinite, and yet without succession there can be no thought or consciousness. And, therefore, to say that God is eternal is to deny that he has either thought or consciousness. 7. Again, benevolence, holiness, justice, wisdom, says Mansell, can be conceived by us only as existing in a benevolent and holy and just and wise being, who is not identical with any one of his attributes, but the common subject of them all. In one word, in a person, but personality, as we conceive it, is essentially a limitation and a relation. To speak of an absolute and infinite persons is simply to use language to which, however true it may be in a superhuman sense, no mode of human thought can possibly attach itself. 352. The conclusion to which Hamilton's argument leads. What then is the result of the whole matter? It is, that if the definitions of the absolute and infinite adopted by transcendentalists be admitted, the laws of reason lead us into a labyrinth of contradictions. If their idea of an infinite and absolute being be correct, then it must include all being actual and possible. It can neither know nor be the object of knowledge. It cannot be conscious, or cause, or a person, or the subject of any moral attribute. Hamilton infers from all this, that a philosophy of the absolute is a sheer impossibility. That the absolute, from its nature and from the necessary limits of human thought, is unknowable, and consequently that the stupendous systems of pantheistic atheism which had been erected on the contrary assumption, must fall to the ground. Those systems have indeed already fallen by their own weight. Although only a few years ago they claimed the homage of the intellectual world and boasted of immutability, they have at the present time scarcely a living advocate. Unhappily, however, Hamilton, like Samson, is involved in the ruin which he created. In overthrowing pantheism, he overthrows theism. All that he says of the absolute as unknowable, he affirms to be true of God. All the contradictions which attend the assumption of an absolute and infinite being as the ground of philosophy, he says, attend the assumption of an infinite God. Section 3. Hamilton's doctrine. A God, an object of faith, but not of knowledge. The sense in which Hamilton and his followers represent God as unknowable has been a matter of dispute. When he says that we can know that God is, but not what he is, he says only what had been said 100 times before. Plato has said that the search after God was difficult, and that when he is found, it is impossible to declare his nature. Philo still more explicitly teaches that the divine essence is without qualities or attributes, and as we know nothing of any essence but by its distinguishing attributes. God in his own nature is altogether unknowable. 353 This is repeated continually by the Greek and Latin fathers, who, however, in most cases at least, meant nothing more than that God is incomprehensible. Others again, in asserting the incapacity of man to know God, refer to his spiritual blindness occasioned by sin. Therefore, while they deny that God can be known by the unregenerate, they affirm that he is known by those to whom the Son has revealed him. In like manner, although the apostle asserts that even the heathen know God, he elsewhere speaks of a kind of knowledge due to the saving illumination of the Holy Spirit. It is in the sense that God is past finding out that the devout Pascal says, 354, we know there is an infinite, but we are ignorant of its nature. We may well know that there is a God, without knowing what he is. And even John Owen says, all the rational conceptions of the minds of men are swallowed up and lost, when they would exercise themselves directly on that which is absolute, immense, eternal, and infinite. When we say it is so, we know not what we say, but only that it is not otherwise. What we deny of God we know in some measure, but what we affirm we know not. Only we declare what we believe and adore. 355 Professor Tyler adds, that while the philosophy of Hamilton confines our knowledge to the condition of finite, it leaves faith free about the unconditioned, the infinite. Indeed constrains us to believe in it by the highest law of our intelligence. Although Hamilton often uses the same language when speaking of God as unknowable, as that employed by others, his meaning is very different. He really teaches an ignorance of God destructive of all rational religion, because inconsistent with the possibility of faith. Different kinds of ignorance. There are different kinds of ignorance. First, there is the ignorance of the idiot, which is blank vacuity. In him the statement of a proposition awakens no mental action whatever. Secondly, there is the ignorance of a blind man, of color. He does not know what color is. But he knows there is something which answers to that word and which produces a certain effect on the eyes of those who see. He may even understand the laws by which the production of color is determined. A blind man has written a treatise on optics. Thirdly, there is the ignorance under which the mind labors when it can prove contradictory propositions concerning the same object, as that the same figure is both square and round. And fourthly, there is the ignorance of imperfect knowledge. Paul speaks of knowing what passes knowledge. Our ignorance of God, according to Hamilton, is neither the ignorance of the idiot nor of imperfect knowledge, but it is analogous to the ignorance of a blind man of colors, and more definitely, the ignorance we labor under with regard to any object of which we can prove contradictions. Proof that Hamilton denies that we can know God. That this view of his doctrine is correct is proved, 1. Because he asserts in such broad terms that God cannot be known. That he is not only inconceivable, but incogitable. 2. Because, he says, that we know that God is not, and cannot be, what we think he is. It is not merely that we cannot determine with certainty that our idea of God is correct, but we know that it is not correct. To think that God is, as we can think him to be, he says, is blasphemy. The last and highest consecration of all true religion must be an altar, agnostotheo, to the unknown and unknowable God. 356:3. Because both he and Mansel continually assert that the infinite cannot be a person, cannot know, cannot be cause, cannot be conscious, cannot be the subject of any moral attributes. To think of God as infinite and to think of him as a person is an impossibility. 4. The illustrations which these writers employ determine clearly their meaning. Our ignorance of God is compared to our incapacity to conceive of two straight lines enclosing a portion of space, or to think a circular parallelogram. It is not merely that we cannot understand such a figure, but we see that, In the nature of things, any such figure is impossible. So we not only cannot understand how God can be absolute and yet a person, but we see that an absolute person is as much a contradiction as a square circle. 5. Accordingly, Herbert Spencer and others, in carrying out Hamilton's principles, come to the conclusion not only that we cannot know God, but that it is impossible that a personal God should exist. There can be no such being. Hamilton's doctrine of God as an object of faith. Hamilton and Mansell, however, are not only theists, but Christians. They believe in God, and they believe in the Scriptures as a divine revelation. They endeavor to avoid what seem to be the inevitable consequences of their doctrine by adopting two principles: first, that the unthinkable is possible, and, therefore, may be believed. By the unthinkable is meant that which the laws of reason force us to regard as self-contradictory. On this subject, Mansell says it is our duty to think of God as personal, and it is our duty to believe that He is infinite. It is true that we cannot reconcile these two representations with each other. As our conception of personality involves attributes apparently contradictory to the notion of infinity, but it does not follow that this contradiction exists anywhere but in our own minds. It does not follow that it implies any impossibility in the absolute nature of God. It proves that there are limits to man's power of thought. And it proves no more. 357. The conclusion is that as whatever is possible is credible, therefore, as it is possible that God, though infinite, may be a person, His personality may be rationally believed. The unthinkable, or impossible, cannot be an object of faith. On this it may be remarked: 1. That there is a great difference between the irreconcilable and the self-contradictory. In the one case, the difficulty arises, or may arise, out of our ignorance or mental weakness. In the other, it arises out of the nature of the things themselves. Many things are irreconcilable to a child which are not so to a man. Many things are irreconcilable to one man and not to another. To men and not to angels. But the self-contradictory is impossible, and is seen to be so by all orders of mind. That 2 and 2 should make 20, or that the same figure should be a square in a circle, is just as irreconcilable to an angel as to a child. What is self-contradictory cannot possibly be true. Now, according to Hamilton and Mansell, infinity and personality are not only irreconcilable, but contradictory. The one affirms what the other denies. According to their doctrine, the infinite cannot be a person, and the person cannot be infinite, any more than the infinite can be finite, or the finite infinite. The one of necessity excludes the other. If you affirm the one, you deny the other. There is a great difference between not seeing how a thing is, and clearly seeing that it cannot be. Hamilton and Mansell constantly assert that an absolute person is a contradiction in terms. And so it is, if their definition of the absolute be correct. And if a contradiction, it is impossible. 2. If to our reason the personality of an infinite God be a contradiction, then it is impossible rationally to believe that He is a person. It is in vain to say that the contradiction is only in our mind, so is faith in our mind. It is impossible for one and the same mind to see a thing to be false, and believe it to be true. For the reason to see that a thing is a contradiction, is to see it to be false. And to see it to be false, and to believe it to be true, is a contradiction in terms. Even if to other and higher minds the contradiction does not exist, so long as it exists in the view of any particular mind, for that mind faith in its truth is an impossibility. It may be said that a man's reason may convince him that the external world does not really exist, while his senses force him to believe in its reality. So reason may pronounce the personality of God a contradiction, and conscience force us to believe that He is a person. This is to confound consecutive with contemporaneous states of mind. It is possible for a man to be an idealist in a study, and a realist out of doors. But he cannot be an idealist and a realist at one and the same time. The mind is a unit. A man's reason is the man himself. So is his conscience, and so are all his other faculties. It is the one substantive self that thinks and believes. To assume, therefore, that by necessity he must think one way and believe another, that the laws of his reason force him to regard as false what his conscience or senses force him to regard as true, is to destroy his rationality. It is also to impugn the wisdom and goodness of our Creator, for it supposes him to have put one part of our constitution in conflict with another. To have placed us under guides who alternately force us to move in opposite directions. It even places this contradiction in God Himself. For what reason, in its legitimate exercise, says, God says? And what conscience, in its legitimate exercise, says, God says? If, therefore, reason says that God is not a person, and conscience says that He is, then with reverence be it spoken, God contradicts Himself. Knowledge essential to faith. It is one of the distinguishing doctrines of Protestants that knowledge is essential to faith. This is clearly the doctrine of Scripture. How can they believe on Him of whom they have not heard? Is the pertinent and instructive query of the Apostle. Faith includes the affirmation of the mind that a thing is true and trustworthy. But it is impossible for the mind to affirm anything of that of which it knows nothing. Romanists indeed say that if a man believes that the Church teaches the truth, then he believes all the Church teaches, although ignorant of its doctrines. It might as well be said that because a child has confidence in his father, therefore he knows all his father knows. Truth must be communicated to the mind, and seen to be possible, before, on any evidence, it can be believed. If, therefore, we cannot know God, we cannot believe in Him. Be regulative knowledge. The second principle which Hamilton and Mansel adopt to save themselves from skepticism is that of regulative knowledge. We are bound to believe that God is what the Scriptures and our moral nature declare Him to be. This revelation, however, does not teach us what God really is, but merely what He wills us to believe concerning Him. Our senses, they say, tell us that things around us are, but not what they are. We can, however, safely act on the assumption that they really are what they appear to be. Our senses, therefore, give only regulative knowledge. That is knowledge sufficient to regulate our active life. So we do not, and cannot, know what God really is. But the representations contained in the Scriptures are sufficient to regulate our moral and religious life. We can safely act on the assumption that He really is what we are thus led to think Him to be, although we know that such is not the fact. We must be content, says Mansel, 358, with those regulative ideas of the Deity, which are sufficient to guide our practice, but not to satisfy our intellect, which tell us not what God is in Himself, but how He wills that we should think of Him. Though this kind of knowledge, says Hampden, 359, is abundantly instructive to us in point of sentiment and action, teaches us, that is, both how to feel, and how to act towards God. For it is the language that we understand, the language formed by our own experience and practice. It is altogether inadequate in point of science. Regulative knowledge, therefore, is that which is designed to regulate our character and practice. It need not be true. Nay, it may be, and is demonstrably false, for Hamilton says it is blasphemy to think that God really is what we take Him to be. Objections to the doctrine of regulative knowledge. 1. The first remark on this doctrine of regulative knowledge is, that it is self-contradictory. Regulative truth is truth designed to accomplish a given end. Design, however, is the intelligent and voluntary adaptation of means to an end. And the intelligent adaptation of means to an end is a personal act. Unless, therefore, God be really a person, there can be no such thing as regulative knowledge. Mr. Mansel says, we cannot know what God is in Himself, but only how He wills that we should think of Him. Here will is attributed to God. And the personal pronouns are used, and must be used in the very statement of the doctrine. That is, we must assume that God is really and not merely in our subjective apprehensions a person, in order to believe in regulative knowledge, which form of knowledge supposes that He is not, or may not be a person. This is a contradiction. 2. Regulative knowledge is, from the nature of the case, powerless, unless its subjects regard it as well-founded. Some parents educate their children in the use of fictions and fairy tales. But belief in the truth of these is essential to their effect. So long as the world believed in ghosts and witches, the belief had power. As soon as men were satisfied that there were no such real existences, their power was gone. Had the philosophers convinced the Greeks that their gods were not real persons, there would have been an end to their mythology. And if Hamilton and his disciples can convince the world that the infinite cannot be a person, the regulative influence of theism is gone. Men cannot be influenced by representations which they know are not conformed to the truth. 3. This theory is highly derogatory to God. It supposes him to propose to influence his creatures by false representations. Revealing himself as father, governor, and judge, when there is no objective truth to answer to these representations. And worse than this, as remarked above, it supposes him to have so constituted our nature as to force us to believe what is not true. We are constrained by the laws of our rational and moral being to think of God as having a nature like our own, and yet we are told it is blasphemy so to regard him. The theory supposes a conflict between reason and conscience, between our rational and moral nature. The latter forcing us to believe that God is a person, and the former declaring personality and deity to be contradictory ideas. We do not forget that Mr. Mansell says that the incogitable may be real, that the contradiction is in our own minds, and not necessarily in the nature of things. But this amounts to nothing. For he says continually that the absolute cannot be a person, cannot be a cause, cannot be conscious, cannot either know or be known. He says, a thing, an object, an attribute, a person, or any other term signifying one out of many possible objects of consciousness, is by that very relation necessarily declared to be finite. 360. That is, if God be a person, he is of necessity finite. Here the personality of God is said not only to be incogitable, or inconceivable, but impossible. And this is the real doctrine of his book. It must be so. It is intuitively true that the whole cannot be a part of itself. And if the infinite be the all, then it cannot be one out of many. If men adopt the principles of pantheists, they cannot consistently avoid their conclusions. Hamilton teaches not merely that God may not be what we think him to be, but that he cannot so be. That we are ignorant what he is. That he is to us an unknown God. If God, by the laws of our reason, thus forces us to deny his personality, and by the laws of our moral nature makes it not only a duty, but a necessity to believe in his personality, then our nature is chaotic. Man, in that case, is not the noble creature that was formed in the image of God. 4. This doctrine of regulative knowledge destroys the authority of the Scriptures. If all that the Bible teaches concerning the nature of God and concerning his relation to the world reveals no objective truth, gives us no knowledge of what God really is, then what it teaches concerning the person, offices, and work of Christ may all be unreal, and there may be no such person and no such Savior. 100 Objections to the whole theory. 1. The first and most obvious fallacy in the theory of Hamilton and Mansell, as it appears to us, lies in their definition of the absolute and infinite, or in the language of Hamilton, the unconditioned. By the absolute they mean that which exists in and of itself, and out of all relation. The infinite is that, than which nothing greater can be conceived or is possible, which includes all actual and all possible modes of being. Mansell subscribes to the dictum of Hegel that the absolute must include all modes of being, good as well as evil. In like manner the infinite must be all. For if any other being exists, the infinite must of necessity be limited, and, therefore, is no longer infinite. These definitions determine everything. If the absolute be that which is incapable of all relation, then it must be alone. Nothing but the absolute can be actual or possible. Then it can neither know nor be known. And if the infinite be all, then again there can be no finite. Then it is just as certain that the absolute and infinite cannot be cause, or conscious, or a person, as that a square cannot be a circle, or the whole a part of itself. When a definition leads to contradictions and absurdities, when it leads to conclusions which are inconsistent with the laws of our nature, and when it subverts all that consciousness, common sense, and the Bible declare to be true, the only rational inference is that the definition is wrong. This inference we have the right to draw in the present case. The very fact that the definitions of the absolute and infinite which Hamilton and Mansell have adopted from the transcendentalists lead to all the fearful conclusions which they draw from them is proof enough that they must be wrong. They are founded upon purely speculative a priori grounds. They can have no authority. For if, as these philosophers say, the absolute and infinite cannot be known, how can it be defined? Neither the etymology nor the usage of the words in question justifies the above given definitions of them. Absolute ab insolvo means free, unrestrained, independent. As when we speak of an absolute monarch or absolute promise. Or, unlimited, as when we speak of absolute space. The word is also used in the sense of finished, or perfect. An absolute being is one that is free, unlimited, independent, and perfect. God is absolute, because he is not dependent for his existence, nature, attributes, or acts, on any other being. He is unlimited, by anything out of himself or independent of his will. But this does not imply that he is the only being, nor that in order to be absolute he must be dead, unconscious, or without thought or will. Much less does the word infinite, as applied to God, imply that he must include all forms of being. Space may be infinite without being duration, and duration may be infinite without being space. An infinite spirit does not include material forms of existence, any more than an infinite line is an infinite surface or an infinite solid. When it is said that anything is infinite, all that is properly meant is that no limit is assignable or possible to it as such. An infinite line is that to which no limit can be assigned as a line. Infinite space is that to which no limit can be assigned as space. An infinite spirit is a spirit which is unlimited in all the attributes of a spirit. It is a great mistake to assume that the infinite must be all. Infinite power is not all power, but simply power to whose efficiency no limitation can be assigned. And infinite knowledge is not all knowledge, but simply knowledge to the extent of which no limit is possible. So too an infinite substance is not all substance, but a substance which is not excluded from any portion of space by other substances, or limited in the manifestation of any of its attributes or functions by anything out of itself. God, therefore, may be a spirit infinite, eternal, and immutable in his being and perfections, without being matter, and sin, and misery. It may be said that as infinite space must include all space, so an infinite being must of necessity include all modes of being. This, however, is a mere play on words. Infinite is sometimes inclusive of all, not from the meaning of the word, but from the nature of the subject of which infinitude is predicated. Infinite space must include all space, because space is in its nature one. But an infinite line does not include all lines, because there may be any number of lines. And an infinite being is not all being, because there may be any number of beings. It must excite the wonder and indignation of ordinary men to see the fundamental truths of religion and morality endangered or subverted out of deference to the assumption that the absolute must be unrelated. Wrong definition of knowledge. 2. The second fallacy involved in Hamilton's theory concerns his idea of knowledge. When it is said that God is unknowable, everything depends on what is meant by knowledge. With him to know is to understand, to have a distinct conception, or mental image. This is evident from his using interchangeably the words unthinkable, unknowable, and inconceivable. Thus on a single page 361 Mansell uses the phrases that of which we do not and cannot think, that which we cannot conceive, and that which we are unable to comprehend, as meaning one and the same thing. This is also proved from the manner in which other words and phrases are employed. For example, the infinite, the absolute, an absolute beginning, an absolute whole, an absolute part, any increase or diminution of the complement of being. The only sense, however, in which these things are unthinkable, is that we cannot form a mental image of them. A distinguished German professor, when anything was said to which he could not assent, was accustomed to spread out his hands and close his eyes and say, "Ich kann gar kein Anschauen davon machen." I cannot see it with my mind's eye, I cannot make an image of it. This seems to be a materialistic way of looking at things. The same may be said of cause, substance, and soul, of none of which can we frame a mental image. Yet they are not unthinkable. A thing is unthinkable only when it is seen to be impossible, or when we can attach no meaning to the words, or proposition, in which it is stated. This impossibility of intelligent thought may arise from our weakness. The problems of the higher mathematics are unthinkable to a child. Or, the impossibility may arise from the nature of the thing itself. That a triangle should have four sides, or a circle be a square, is absolutely unthinkable. But in neither of these senses is the infinite unthinkable. It is not impossible, for Hamilton and Mansell both admit that God is in fact infinite. Nor is that proposition unintelligible. It conveys a perfectly clear and distinct idea to the mind. When the mind affirms to itself that space is infinite, that is that it cannot be limited, it knows what it means just as well as when it says that 2 and 2 are 4. Neither is an absolute beginning unthinkable. If, indeed, by absolute beginning is meant uncaused beginning, the coming into existence of something out of nothing, and produced by nothing, then it is impossible and therefore incogitable. But the dictum is applied to a creation ex nihilo, which is declared to be unthinkable. This, however, is denied. We will to move a limb, and it moves. God said, "Let there be light," and light was. The one event is just as intelligible as the other. In neither case can we comprehend the nexus between the antecedent and the consequent, between the volition and the effect. But as facts they are equally thinkable and knowable. It is not possible to give the evidence scattered through the writings of Hamilton and Mansell, that they use the word to know in the sense of comprehending, or forming a mental image of the object known. Mansell 362 quotes the following sentence from Dr. M. C. Kosh's work on the method of the divine government, namely, "The mind seeks in vain to embrace the infinite in a positive image, but is constrained to believe, when its efforts fail, that there is a something to which no limits can be put." This sentence Mansell says may be accepted by the most uncompromising adherent of Sir W. Hamilton's doctrine, that the infinite is unthinkable and unknowable. To know, therefore, according to Hamilton and Mansell, is to form a mental image of. And as we cannot form such an image of God, God cannot be known. Mansell is disposed to think that this reduces the controversy to a matter of words. And Drive Tyler, in his able exposition of Hamilton's philosophy, says, 363, "So it be admitted, as it must, that all our intelligence of God is by analogy, it matters but little, practically, whether the conviction be called knowledge, belief, or faith. It is, however, very far from being a dispute about words. For Hamilton constantly asserts that God is not, and cannot be, what we think he is. Then we have no God. For what is God as infinite, if, as Mansell says, the infinite, if it is to be conceived at all, must be conceived as potentially everything and actually nothing? 364. What is meant by knowledge? Knowledge is the perception of truth. Whatever the mind perceives, whether intuitively or discursively, to be true, that it knows. We have immediate knowledge of all the facts of consciousness. And with regard to other matters, some we can demonstrate, some we can prove analogically, some we must admit or involve ourselves in contradictions and absurdities. Whatever process the mind may institute, if it arrives at a clear perception that a thing is, then that thing is an object of knowledge. It is thus we know the object with which heaven and earth are crowded. It is thus we know our fellow men. With regard to anything without us, when our ideas, or convictions concerning it, correspond to what the thing really is, then we know it. How do we know that our nearest friend has a soul, and that that soul has intelligence, moral excellence, and power? We cannot see or feel it. We cannot form a mental image of it. It is mysterious and incomprehensible. Yet we know that it is, and what it is, just as certainly as we know that we ourselves are, and what we are. In the same way we know that God is, and what he is. We know that he is a spirit, that he has intelligence, moral excellence, and power to an infinite degree. We know that he can love, pity, and pardon. That he can hear and answer prayer. We know God in the same sense and just as certainly as we know our father or mother. And no man can take this knowledge from us, or persuade us that it is not knowledge, but a mere irrational belief. Hamilton's doctrine leads to skepticism. 3. The principles on which Hamilton and Mansell deny that God can be known, logically lead to skepticism. Hamilton has indeed rendered invaluable service to the cause of truth by his defense of what is, perhaps, infelicitously called the philosophy of common sense. The principles of that philosophy are 1. That what is given in consciousness is undoubtedly true. 2. That whatever the laws of our nature force us to believe, must be accepted as true. 3. That this principle applies to all the elements of our nature, to the senses, the reason, and the conscience. We cannot rationally or consistently with our allegiance to God, deny what our senses, reason, or conscience pronounce to be true. 4. Neither the individual man, nor the cause of truth, however, is to be left to the mercy of what anyone may choose to say reason or conscience teaches. Nothing is to be accepted as the authoritative judgment of either reason or conscience, which does not bear the criteria of universality and necessity. Hamilton has drawn from the stores of his erudition, in this department perhaps unexampled, proof that these principles have been recognized by the leading philosophic minds in all ages. He himself sustains them with earnestness as the safeguards of truth. He impressively asserts that if consciousness once be convicted of falsehood, all is lost. We have then no resting place for either science or religion. That absolute skepticism follows, if it be denied that necessity and universality of belief are not decisive proof of the truth of what is thus believed. Even Stuart Mill admits that, whatever is known to us by consciousness, is known beyond possibility of question. 365 Mr. Mansell tells us that it is from consciousness we get our idea of substance, of personality, of cause, of right and wrong, in short of everything which lies at the foundation of knowledge and religion. And therefore if consciousness deceive us we have nothing to depend upon. Mansell thus expounds the famous aphorism of Descartes, cogito ergo sum, that is I, who see, and hear, and think, and feel, am the one continuous self, whose existence gives unity and connection to the whole. Personality comprises all that we know of that which exists. Relation to personality comprises all that we know of that which seems to exist. 366 Consciousness, he says, gives us the knowledge of substance. We are a substantive existence. 367 I exist as I am conscious of existing. And conscious self is itself the thing and sick, the standard by which all representations of personality must be judged, and from which our notion of reality, as distinguished from appearance, is originally derived. 368 Hamilton and Mansell therefore teach that the veracity of consciousness is the foundation of all knowledge, and that the denial of that veracity inevitably leads to absolute skepticism. Nevertheless, they teach that our senses deceive us, that reason deceives us, the conscience deceives us. That is, that our sensuous, rational, and moral consciousness are alike deceptive and unreliable. Our senses give us the knowledge of the external world. They teach us that things are, and what they are. It is admitted that the universal and irresistible belief of men, as that belief is determined by their sense and consciousness, is that things really are what to our senses they appear to be. Philosophers tell us this is a delusion. Kant says that they certainly are not what we take them to be. Mansell says this is going rather too far. We cannot know, indeed, what they are, but it is possible that they are in fact what they appear to be. In either case they are to us all unknown quantity, and the senses deceive us. They assume to teach more than they have a right to teach, and we are bound to believe them. Kant teaches that our reason, that the necessary laws of thought which govern our mental operations, lead to absolute contradictions. In this Hamilton and Mansell fully agree with him. They tell us that reason teaches that the absolute must be all things actual and possible. That there cannot be an absolute or infinite person, or cause. That being and not being are identical. That the infinite is potentially all things and actually nothing. These and similar contradictions are said to be inevitable results of all attempts to know God as an absolute and infinite being. The conception of the absolute and infinite, from whatever side we view it, appears encompassed with contradictions. There is a contradiction in supposing such an object to exist, whether alone or in conjunction with others. And there is a contradiction in supposing it not to exist. There is a contradiction in conceiving it as one, and there is a contradiction in conceiving it as many. There is a contradiction in conceiving it as personal. And there is a contradiction in conceiving it as impersonal. It cannot without contradiction be represented as active. Nor, without equal contradiction, be represented as inactive. It cannot be conceived as the sum of all existence. Nor yet can it be conceived of as a part only of that sum. 369 Yet all this we are called upon to believe. For it is our duty, he says, to believe that God is infinite and absolute. That is, we are bound to believe what our rational consciousness pronounces to be contradictory and impossible. Conscience, or our moral consciousness, is no less deceptive. M.R. Mansell admits that we are conscious of dependence and of moral obligation. That this involves what he calls the consciousness of God, that is that we stand in the relation to God of one spirit to another spirit, of one person to another person. A person so superior to us as to have rightfully supreme authority over us, and who has all the power and all the moral perfections which enter into our idea of God. But all this is a delusion. It is a delusion, because what our moral consciousness thus teaches involves all the contradictions and absurdities above mentioned. Because it is said to teach not what God is, but only what it is desirable that we should think he is. And because we are told that it is blasphemy to think that he is what we take him to be. The theory, therefore, of Hamilton and Mansell as to the knowledge of God is suicidal. It is inconsistent with the veracity of consciousness, which is the fundamental principle of their philosophy. The theory is an incongruous combination of sceptical principles with orthodox faith, the antitheistic principles of Kant with theism. One or the other must be given up. We cannot believe in a personal God, if an infinite person be a contradiction and absurdity. God has not so constituted our nature as to make it of necessity deceptive. The senses, reason, and conscience, within their appropriate spheres, and in their normal exercise, are trustworthy guides. They teach us real, and not merely apparent or regulative truth. Their combined spheres comprehend all the relations in which we, as rational creatures, stand to the external world, to our fellow men, and to God. Were it not for the disturbing element of sin, we know not that man, in full communion with his Maker, whose favor is light and life, would have needed any other guides. But man is not in his original and normal state. In apostatizing from God, man fell into a state of darkness and confusion. Reason and conscience are no longer adequate guides as to the things of God. Of fallen men, the Apostle says that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Romans 1:21-23. Or, worse yet, into an absolute and infinite being, without consciousness, intelligence, or moral character. A being which is not potentially all things, and actually nothing. It is true, therefore, as the same. Apostle tells us, that the world by wisdom knows not God. It is true in a still higher sense, as the Lord himself says, that no man knoweth the Father, save the Son, any to whomsoever the Son will reveal him. Matthew 11:27. Necessity of a supernatural revelation. We need, therefore, a divine supernatural revelation. Of this revelation, it is to be remarked, first, that it gives us real knowledge. It teaches us what God really is. What sin is. What the law is. What Christ and the plan of salvation through him are. And what is to be the state of the soul after death. The knowledge thus communicated is real, in the sense that the ideas which we are thus led to form of the things revealed conform to what those things really are. God and Christ, holiness and sin, heaven and hell, really are what the Bible declares them to be. Sir William Hamilton 370 divides the objects of knowledge into two classes: those derived from within, from the intelligence, and those derived from experience. The latter are of two kinds: what we know from our own experience, and what we know from the experience of others, authenticated to us by adequate testimony. In the generally received sense of the word, this is true knowledge. No man hesitates to say that he knows that there was such a man as Washington, or such an event as the American Revolution. If the testimony of men can give us clear and certain knowledge of facts beyond our experience, surely the testimony of God is greater. What he reveals is made known. We apprehend it as it truly is. The conviction that what God reveals is made known in its true nature is the very essence of faith in the divine testimony. We are certain, therefore, that our ideas of God, founded on the testimony of his word, correspond to what he really is, and constitute true knowledge. It is also to be remembered that while the testimony of men is to the mind, the testimony of God is not only to, but also within the mind. It illuminates and informs. So that the testimony of God is called the demonstration of the Spirit. The second remark concerning the revelation contained in the Scriptures is, that while it makes known truths far above the reach of sense or reason, it reveals nothing which contradicts either. It harmonizes with our whole nature. It supplements all our other knowledge, and authenticates itself by harmonizing the testimony of enlightened consciousness with the testimony of God and His Word. The conclusion, therefore, of the whole matter is, that we know God in the same sense in which we know ourselves and things out of ourselves. We have the same conviction that God is, and that He is, in Himself, and independently of our thought of Him, what we take Him to be. Our subjective idea corresponds to the objective reality. This knowledge of God is the foundation of all religion. And therefore to deny that God can be known, is really to deny that rational religion is possible. In other words, it makes religion a mere sentiment, or blind feeling, instead of its being what the apostle declares it to be, a logik latria, a rational service. The homage of the reason as well as of the heart and life. Our knowledge of God, says Hayes, developed and enlightened by the Scriptures, answers to what God really is, for He cannot deceive us as to His own nature. 371.